You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Ladies and gentlemen, if I'm so crazy, if I'm such a radical, why is it that I am so consistently right? In fact, so consistently right that I have been the most accurate forecaster of future events in the entire history of the human race, bar none. If you don't believe it, check out my record. Today, it was revealed that Harris, one of the two perpetrators of the shootings at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado, was indeed under the care of a mental health professional and was taking a prescription psychiatric drug. And I'm here to tell you, the other boy was also. But you see, this is privileged information. In our investigations of all of these random shooting incidents, ever since Purdy opened fire on the schoolyard in Stockton, California, we have found that every single one of the perpetrators were either a current or an ex-mental patient under the care of a mental health professional taking prescription psychiatric drugs. And all of these shootings have either occurred immediately prior to major gun legislation or crime bills, or at the time of the year, right around April 19th, the traditional time of sacrifice on behalf of the old pagan gods, which, by the way, have returned in the New Age and in the New World Order humanist religions. So ask yourself that. If I'm such a nut, if I'm so crazy, if I'm such a extreme, radical, right-wing dude, why is it that I am so consistently right? So consistently right to the point that I have been the most accurate forecaster of major future events in the entire history of the human race. We continue with our documented and sourced revelation of the treason that has occurred in this country. Pay very close attention, ladies and gentlemen. Make sure you have pen and paper, and that you take copious notes. I challenge you. Prove me wrong.
I wonder who out there is going to believe that. I continue. The character of the program has sometimes been misunderstood. It has been called a big money program, a means of scattering dollars around the world. Obviously, it is not that, but a means of spreading ideas and skills. It has been called a welfare program. Obviously, it is that, in the best sense of the word. Some people have asked, why should we help the people of these underdeveloped areas to raise their standard of living when we have plenty of Americans who need that kind of help? The answer, of course, is that we can do both. And we are, in fact, doing both. And that is a total lie. I continue. Many Point 4 projects are patterned on, for example, the work we are doing right here at home in soil conservation, irrigation, and public health. All such programs, both at home and abroad, enlarge our experience and our knowledge. The exchange in ideas and skills is a two-way traffic. Some people have asked, what has Point 4 got to do with stopping communism? Is this the time to be helping people on the other side of the world to raise better crops and stamp out malaria? The answer is that this is the very time that most of the people we are working with are less interested in abstract principles of communism and democracy than in solving the urgent problems of hunger, disease, and the difficulty of scratching for a bare living. The communists offer them quick remedies for all their ills. We have a chance to prove to them in practical and concrete ways that a free society can promote both human well-being and human dignity. Next chapter, World Trade and World Peace. The European Recovery Program has lifted the Great European Workshop back to its feet and has put millions of highly skilled people back into productive work. The Point 4 program will in time create new centers of production and will help millions of people in Latin America, Africa, and the Middle and Far East to develop their skills and resources. Both these programs are designed to raise standards of living through production. But production is never an end in itself. Goods are useful only if they can be bought, sold, and consumed. The peace and well-being of the world depends on trade. On a healthy, expanding trade by which wealth can circulate freely to the widest possible extent and create a demand for new wealth. International trade, therefore, is a second major concern of our economic policy. As with European recovery, the problem is not to restore an old system, but to develop a new and better one. The United States has a strong interest in helping to build a healthy international trading system, which will act as a preventive to depressions and economic warfare. During the past 36 years, we have become a great creditor nation. In that period, the value of our exports has exceeded the value of our imports by about $100 billion with a B dollars. This is called a favorable balance of trade. But even by strictly economic standards, it is not favorable at all, since the $100 billion gap has had to be financed by the American people through direct taxation and government loans, interest on which comes from taxes. But this export surplus has been necessary to our national security, for it reinforced our allies in two world wars and contributed to their recovery in the post-war years. The problem of today is to develop a sound, balanced system of world trade. The American Reciprocal Trade Agreements Program has taken us a long step in that direction, and pay very close attention now, ladies and gentlemen. It reversed the high tariff policy of the 1920s and set us firmly on the road toward a more enlightened policy of opening up the channels of world trade. Under the authority of the Reciprocal Trade Agreements Act, the United States joined with 22 other major trading nations at Geneva in 1947 in the greatest tariff bargaining meeting in history. The result of that meeting was a General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, GATT. Again, was a General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, GATT. And you thought GATT was new. GATT has been planned and has been in the workings and has been an actual fact for many years. It was GATT that gave the foreign nations the edge in charging us higher tariffs while we lowered ours. It has caused the destruction of the industrial base of the United States of America, and it's continuing with NAFTA. The result of that meeting was a General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, GATT, which reduced tariffs rates sharply and affected half the world's imports. The only tariff rates that were reduced were ours. The rest of the world raised theirs. The same bargaining process was repeated at Annecy, France, in 1949 with 11 more countries present. And this conference led in turn to a third round of tariff-cutting negotiations at Torquay, England in 1950. Every country got and made concessions, and every concession that was made to one country immediately applied to all those present. Thus, the free nations made an unprecedented all-out attack on one of the most serious obstacles to the flow of trade. But even more stubborn obstacles remain to be overcome. Today, anyone who tries to buy or sell across national boundaries can still become entangled in a jungle of government controls in the form of quotas, customs regulations, and currency restrictions. To get rid of this tangle of restrictions will require time and a spirit of give and take, for no nation is willing to discard its economic armor while the rest remain armed. The ultimate answer to this difficult problem is in the general acceptance of a code of fair trade practices. 54 nations have agreed on such a code and embodied it in the Charter for an international trade organization. The charter sets the minimum rules of the game on which all 54 nations are now willing to agree. They are not ideal rules by any means, but they can be improved as the nations get experience in cooperation and gain confidence in each other. The charter also provides for an organization within the family of the United Nations, a place where the members can meet and settle their trade problems across a conference table. There has never been before such a place. The organization and the charter offer at least a rational hope that economic warfare can be ended in the not too distant future. The ITO charter is now before the American Congress for approval. Other nations are waiting to see whether the United States will live up to its enlightened economic principles. Those who support the ITO believe that it will pave the way for closer political as well as economic cooperation among the free nations and thus contribute to the security of the United States. This American attitude has an ethical as well as a political background. For as Secretary Acheson has said, the truth is that just as no man and no government is wise enough or disinterested enough to direct the thinking and the action of another individual, so no nation and no people are wise enough and disinterested enough very long to assume the responsibility for another people or to control another people's opportunities. Do you understand, ladies and gentlemen, how they say one thing out of one side of their mouth and then absolutely, completely contradict it in the very next paragraph? These people are consummate liars, consummate deceivers, and consummate manipulators.
And before we continue, ladies and gentlemen, I forgot to inform you that a student in Canada wearing a blue trench coat walked into a school and killed two people. I told you it was not over. You can expect an ever-increasing wave of violence to envelop this country and other countries. Perpetrated, we will be told, by children, lone nuts, who will walk into schools, shopping centers, fast food restaurants, and other places where large numbers of people are congregated and kill at random with no apparent motive. I told you this would happen in 1988 before Purdy walked onto the school ground in Stockton, California, and opened fire on those young elementary school children. I wrote it in my book, Behold a Pale Horse, that was published in December of 1990. I have been telling you this and repeating it in all my speeches and lectures over the years, and on many of the broadcasts of the Hour of the Time, ever since the first broadcast on May the 4th, 1992. I told you what they would find eventually with these two young men on the evening of April the 20th, 1999, the day that the shootings in Columbine High School occurred. I do not like being right. I hate it, in fact. But nevertheless, I am right. And you had better pay attention. We now continue.
They are the best in the world, in fact. Some Americans have been troubled by the fact that the nations whose independence we have helped to establish and maintain have not all had representative governments or practical democracy as we understand it. This raises the question of what we mean when we speak of free nations and free peoples. It is worth clearing up this question, which has caused a good deal of confusion about American policy. A free country is one that does not have to take orders from a foreign government. Believing as we do that national independence is a stepping stone to popular government and personal liberty, we set a high value on the independence even of those nations which cannot by any stretch of the imagination be called democracies. The fact that we help a country to be free of foreign domination does not mean that we support the particular government it happens to have at any particular time. It means that we want the kind of international community in which each nation is free to manage its own affairs, subject, of course, to its pledges and responsibilities under the United Nations Charter. Out one side of their mouth, they say, a free country is one that does not have to take orders from a foreign government. And out the other side of their mouth, they say, it means that we want the kind of international community in which each nation is free to manage its own affairs, subject, of course, to its pledges and responsibilities under the United Nations Charter, which is a foreign government. Within the broad area of the Charter, there's plenty of room for people to experiment and to change their forms of government if they wish. Plenty of room for progress toward democracy, which I have told you on many of these broadcasts is just another word for socialism. In recent years, the United States has had a chance to prove that it is still the traditional friend of young nations, still the champion of people seeking their independence. Since the end of the Second World War, more than 500 million people have gained their independence. 8 new nations have been born. The United States has assisted at the birth of these nations as far as it could. It has vigorously supported their membership of the United Nations. That whole paragraph, ladies and gentlemen, is a complete lie. During those years, free nations fell to communism and no new free nations were created. Check your history books. If you can find one, this still has the true history. I continue, in the Philippines, we had our best opportunity to demonstrate that American policy means what it says. The 20 million citizens of those islands celebrated their independence on July 4, 1946, as a result of a promise we made and kept. Moreover, we not only welcomed them into the community of nations, but helped them to organize and finance their free society, and they were, in fact, ladies and gentlemen, a puppet of the United States government. They were not free at all. To India, Pakistan, Burma, and Ceylon, we are giving our strong and friendly support. The people of Israel have had America's moral and material backing since the beginning of their struggle for nationhood. Ladies and gentlemen, the truth is the United States and London created the nation state of Israel by forcing European Jews to migrate on ships that very frequently sank right out from under them. Americans can take pride in their contribution to the creation of the Republic of Indonesia. During the long and difficult negotiations between the Indonesian and Netherlands governments, American diplomacy played an important and sometimes a decisive part in bringing the parties together and in helping them finally to work out a satisfactory agreement. I skip to page 94, bottom. Soviet and Chinese communists charged the United States with aggression in Formosa and brought the matter before the Security Council. The United States welcomed a United Nations investigation and, in fact, suggested that a United Nations commission be sent to Formosa to observe and report the facts. So that American policy would be clearly understood both at home and abroad, the President summarized our aims and our hopes in a radio talk on September 1, 1950. And I quote, "First, we believe in the United Nations." Notice the first thing that President Truman said, the first thing out of his mouth is, quote, First, above everything else, first, we believe in the United Nations. When we ratified its charter, we pledged ourselves to seek peace and security through this world organization. We kept our word when we went to the support of the United Nations in Korea 2 months ago. We shall never go back on that pledge. Second, we believe the Koreans have a right to be free, independent, and united as they want to be under the direction and guidance of the United Nations. We, with others, will do our part to help them enjoy that right. The United States has no other aim in Korea. Third, we do not want the fighting in Korea to expand into a general war. It will not spread unless communist imperialism draws other armies and governments into the fight of the aggressors against the United Nations, which isn't even a country. Fourth, we hope in particular that the people of China will not be misled or forced into fighting against the United Nations and against the American people. In that paragraph, folks, they have really stated their real meaning. For the meaning of that sentence is that the United States and the United Nations are one and the same. I'll read it again, just in case you sheeple missed it. Fourth, we hope in particular that the people of China will not be misled or forced into fighting against the United Nations and against the American people. Only the communist imperialism, which has already started to dismember China, could gain from China's involvement in war. Fifth, we do not want Formosa or any part of Asia for ourselves. We believe that the future of Formosa, like that of any other territory in dispute, should be settled peacefully. We believe that it should be settled by international action and not by the decision of the United States or of any other state alone. International action, ladies and gentlemen, means the United Nations, which means the United States. The mission of the Seventh Fleet is to keep Formosa out of the conflict. Our purpose is peace, not conquest. Sixth, we believe in freedom for all nations of the Far East. That is one of the reasons why we are fighting under the United Nations for the freedom of Korea. We helped the Philippines become independent, and we have supported the national aspirations to independence of other Asian countries. Russia has never voluntarily given up any territory it has acquired in the Far East. It has never given independence to any people who have fallen under its control. We not only want freedom for the peoples of Asia, but we also want to help them secure for themselves better health, more food, better clothes and homes, and the chance to live their own lives in peace under the United Nations. The things we want for the people of Asia are the same things we want for the people of the rest of the world. Seventh, we do not believe in aggressive or preventive war. Such war is the weapon of dictators, not of free democratic countries like the United States. We are arming only for defense against aggression. Even though communist imperialism does not believe in peace, it can be discouraged from new aggression if we and other free peoples are strong, determined, and united. Eighth, we want peace, and we shall achieve it. Our men are fighting for peace today in Korea. We are working for peace constantly in the United Nations and in all the capitals of the world. Our workers, our farmers, our businessmen, all our vast resources are helping now to create the strength which will make peace secure and get this, folks, the rights of man. The United Nations Charter pledged all its signers to respect and promote human rights and fundamental freedoms, but it did not define those rights and freedoms. One of the first tasks of the United Nations, therefore, was to get general agreement among its members on what those words meant. To be realistic, such an agreement would have to express the honest beliefs and aims of all the nations that put their names to it. It must, in short, be a common denominator of conviction rather than a pious hope. The United States worked hard for such an agreement. American organizations gave it vigorous support, and our American chairman, Mrs. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, guided its progress through the Human Rights Commission. In 1948, the General Assembly approved and first International Declaration of Human Rights. The next step is to get the principles affirmed and the declaration accepted in practice as part of the constitutions and law of nations. This will become most important to you later when we get into some of the later documents, when you see what this really means. This is a work of many years, but the Economic and Social Council has already undertaken the drafting of human rights treaties, or covenants. Covenants, ladies and gentlemen. Remember when William Clinton, the communist, socialist, Marxist, draft-dodging, lying scum, who pretends to be the president of the United States of America, but who is really the president of a criminal counterfeit government, which has relegated our Constitution and Bill of Rights to the trash can. Covenants, I continue, which will bind the nations that sign them to guarantee certain basic rights to their citizens. Each covenant will have to take into consideration the particular problems of a particular nation, its legal system, and its method of dealing with violations. The drafting of human rights covenants is one of the boldest as well as one of the most difficult projects ever conceived by a group of nations. In the judgments of history, this quiet and generally unsung work may rank as one of the great revolutionary enterprises of the United Nations. Now understand what was said there, ladies and gentlemen. They're drafting a covenant. It is one of the boldest as well as one of the most difficult projects ever conceived by a group of nations. Now listen, in the judgment of history, this quiet and generally unsung work may rank as one of the great revolutionary enterprises of the United Nations, and that is in the symbology and the words of the mysteries. Another is the outlawing by the United Nations of genocide or mass murder of whole groups of people, such as Nazi Germany officially practiced In 1948, the General Assembly unanimously approved a convention pledging its members to treat genocide as a crime and to punish it accordingly. This treaty is now up for ratification. Since then, ladies and gentlemen, it has been ratified, and nobody wants to see anybody eliminated. Nobody wants to see genocide enacted on any people. But when you read this treaty, you will understand that it suggests citizens of the United States of America to be arrested by the United Nations and tried in a United Nations court anywhere that they deem that they want to try that citizen just for saying a word that hurts the feelings of someone else of a different group. If you don't believe that, ladies and gentlemen, in one of these future programs, in the near future, I am going to read that treaty to you and prove it. It is a method of exerting absolute control. In other words, thought control, political correctness. Where do you think all this comes from? It's been in the works for many, many years. Our government has been riddled with traitors. It is treasonous. Joseph McCarthy was right. He just didn't know what to call these scum. When they attacked him, no one came to his aid. He goes on to say, our interest in human rights is not confined to the making of treaties and declarations. We are working for such concrete things as the free gathering of news, the free movements of peoples, and the free exchange of knowledge. The United Nations, through the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization and other specialized agencies, offers many channels for concrete progress along these lines. There is no need to create a ferment of ideas in the world. It already exists. The need, and this the United Nations can meet, is to translate the ideas of freedom and progress into practical, ladies and gentlemen, terms of better health, better nutrition, better homes and schools, in short, the chance to work for a better life. This is all translated over the years into socialism, the welfare state. The American nation began life with the Declaration of Independence. We hold and still hold those truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these rights are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Today, the foreign policy of the United States is a declaration of the interdependence of men and nations, and I will read that declaration to you verbatim in one of the programs to come. We have over 400 pages of documents to read to you outlining the beginning, the conduct, the carrying out, and the end result of the treason. The destruction of the United States of America wholesale, the ripping apart, the shredding of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, and the enslavement of the American people under a one-world totalitarian socialist government. A Department of State publication, number 3972, entitled Our Foreign Policy. Ordered written by Harry S. Truman and signed by Harry S. Truman. It was from the General Foreign Policies Series, number 26, released September 1950. Printed by the Division of Publications, Office of Public Affairs, Department of State. Ladies and gentlemen, a lot of people called today wanting to know what the name of the publication was and where to get it. Now, I have 400 pages of documentation to read to you over the air to prove that not only was there a conspiracy, it has been carried out over the years, and the Constitution is no longer the supreme law of the land. In fact, it was thrown in the trash can, flushed many years ago. I cannot babysit you any longer. I've been telling you every episode of the Hour of the Time to have a pen and paper with you by your side, and I expect you to do it. They have declared war upon us. They have destroyed this country. For all intents and purposes, it is gone. I have the documentation here in front of me. It is a fact. It is not speculation. I did not make this up. And if you listen to every episode of the Hour of the Time, 2 hours each day, you're going to get this documentation. I'm going to give you the names of these publications and these documents every single night.
You write them down. You go to your libraries. You go to the Library of Congress. You go to the Congressional Register. You go to your state university, and you find these documents, and don't you call us and ask us to do it for you.
It's a hell of a time, cause the federal government, the brothers of the day, the ones in your hands. People are over in every town, selling to the fire, baby, down on the ground. Out of control, people pouring the pond. Now jumping on the neighborhood, every door. Mother, loser, kills the thieves. Now everyone's looking for another disease. 300 million people on a planet made for three. Now who's gonna set this hell down free?
Ladies and gentlemen, if you want to know why, you want to know why public officials are voting to take away your firearms, first research their history. Look at who they are. Look at the organizations they belong to. Look at where they went to school. Don't listen to the promises that they gave you to get into office. Watch what they do. They go to your local library. No matter where you live in the United States, tell the librarian to show you where the United States code books are shelved. There are 25 books in the set, folks. They are reddish brown in color. They are printed by the government printing office in Washington, D.C. These hardcover books are printed every 8 to 10 years. They are updated with annual softback supplements each year until a new hardcover issue comes out. At the present time, the 1989 United States code books are on the shelf. The 1989. You want, ladies and gentlemen, you want Public Law 87-297. Public Law 87-297. That's in Title 22, United States Code, Section 2551. If your library has the 1982 edition, which some libraries still do, go to Volume 9. You'll find it on page 554. Here you will find Public Law 87-297, which calls for the United States to eliminate its armed forces. This law was signed for the United States in 1961. John Fitzgerald Kennedy signed it, and every president since has worked to enact its provisions. The government knows you will not approve, which is why they want to take away your firearms before you find out that it's already been done. Already been done. The Brady Bill is a scam. All this firearms legislation that they are introducing is a scam. It's already been done. The Secretary of the Treasury, all he has to do is sign his name to a document and it's all over. All over. What they're doing now is trying to garner a public consensus of support so that they will not be found out and hung as the traitors that they are. Then turn to page 555, and remember this is only in the 1982 edition. Here you will find the definition of what the government means by disarmament. You can find it on the lower right-hand side of the page. The disarmament calls for the elimination of our armed forces. It also calls for the elimination of weapons of all kinds. This is Title 22, United States Code, Section 2552, Subtitle A. Then turn to page 557. Here you will find it stated in item A, control, reduction, and elimination of armed forces. And as item D, elimination of armed forces. These traitors in Washington have been operating in concert with the Soviet Union to bring about a one-world government. The collapse of the Soviet Union was from the top down and not from the cries of the people and is part of a well-orchestrated plan. What you need to know is that your armed forces are being eliminated from national control, which in turn wipes out our sovereignty as a nation. It's already been done on paper. It must be done with the public approval. In two stages, we shall have no more army, no more navy, and no more air force. In the third stage, we will have a zero military. Before stage one closes, all citizen-owned guns will be banned. Actually, that's after stage two, folks. We are in the second year, ladies and gentlemen, of stage two. Public Law 87-297 is further explained in the State Department document called Publication 7277. Your librarian can also furnish you a copy, or could, until they found out what we were doing, and now we have run a check, and we can only find that publication in two libraries in the entire country. It has been removed. I'm not going to tell you which libraries, because I don't think they know it's there, and I don't want to give it away. If you are diligent in your search, you will find it. If not, we will furnish you with a copy when these documents are published. The blueprint for the peace race is a 35-page booklet printed by the United States Arms Control and Disarmament Agency as publication number 4, General Series 3, released May 1962. Publication number 4 is the unabridged version of State Department Document 7277, and we will read both of these documents to you over the air during this series. Both of these booklets explain how our military is to be reduced to 2.1 million men. China and the Soviets are to reduce to that level also, and are in the process of doing it. At this point, we are in stage one, at which time we are to transfer on a permanent basis one half of our armed forces to be merged with the Russian and Chinese armies. In stage two, the remaining one half of our armed forces is then turned over to the same Security Council of the United Nations. The person in charge of the merged armies must, by prior agreement, always be a Russian. We will document that later in the series. The world's smaller nations turn 100% of their armies over to the same Undersecretary of the Security Council in Stage 2. President George Bush and Admiral William J. Crow refer to this process as being in transition. The exchange of officers between the Russian and what used to be Soviet bloc countries and the United States military has been taking place for some time. We now are training Russian officers in our military academies, and some of our officers are attending Russian military academies. This plan was implemented a long time ago, ladies and gentlemen. The law has been amended several times. People read about this in my book and sent me letters. In the letters, they say, oh, yeah, but everybody got mad, and they made an amendment to the law that said that nothing in this law is construed to mean that they're going to take guns away from the American citizens. Well, tonight I'm going to read you what that really says, and then you're going to show what they did after that. Because except under the law are under a treaty, and both of those have been accomplished. United States Code 1988 edition, you will find this law as it has been amended, containing the general and permanent laws of the United States in force on January the 3rd, 1989, prepared and published under authority of Title II, United States Code, Section 285B, by the Office of the Law Revision Council of the House of Representatives. Volume 9, Title 22, Foreign Relations and Intercourse, to Title 25, Indians, United States Government Printing Office, Washington, 1989. Going to quote verbatim, ladies and gentlemen, pay attention. Subchapter 1, General Provisions. Section 2551, Congressional Statement of Purpose. Listen to this lie. This is the Congressional Statement of Purpose. This is an admission by the Congress of the United States as to their ultimate goal. And I quote, "An ultimate goal of the United States is a world which is free from the scourge of war and the dangers and burdens of armaments, in which the use of force has been subordinated to the rule of law, and in which international adjustments to a changing world are achieved peacefully. It is the purpose of this chapter to provide impetus toward this goal by creating a new agency of peace to deal with the problem of reduction and control of armaments, looking toward ultimate world disarmament." Under our Constitution, that is unconstitutional, it is criminal, it is treasonous. They have not changed the Constitution of the United States. The second article in amendment guarantees us our right to have a militia, and it specifically states that our right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Pay attention. Title 22, Foreign Relations and Intercourse, page 652, same volume. Public Law 87-297, Title 1. Definitions as used in this chapter. A. The terms arms control and disarmament mean the identification, verification, inspection, limitation, control, and reduction or elimination of armed forces and armaments of all kinds under international agreement, including the necessary steps taken under such an agreement to establish an effective system of international control or to create and strengthen international organizations for the maintenance of peace. Public Law 87-297, Title 1, Subsection 3, September 26, 1961. Statute 631, Subchapter 2, Organization. United States Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. There is established an agency to be known as the United States Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. Page 654, subtitle 2568, Functions. The director is authorized and directed to exercise his powers in such manner as to ensure the acquisition of a fund of theoretical and practical knowledge concerning disarmament. To this end, the director is authorized and directed under the direction of the president, one, to ensure the conduct of research, development, and other studies in the field of arms control and disarmament. Two, to make arrangements including contracts, agreements, and grants for the conduct of research, development, and other studies in the field of arms control and disarmament by private or public institutions or persons. And three, to coordinate the research, development, and other studies conducted in the field of arms control and disarmament by or for other government agencies in accordance with procedures established under Section 2575 of this title. In carrying out his responsibilities under this chapter, the director shall, to the maximum extent feasible, make full use of available facilities, government and private. The authority of the director with respect to research, development, and other studies shall be limited to participation in the following insofar as they relate to arms control and disarmament. A. Control, reduction, and elimination of armed forces and armaments. The detection, identification, inspection, monitoring, limitation, reduction, control, and elimination of armed forces and armaments, including thermonuclear, nuclear missile, conventional, bacteriological, chemical, and radiological weapons. Now, folks, they make it sound like they're talking just about armed forces of nations, and that is not true, as you will find out later. D. The control, reduction, and elimination of armed forces and armaments in space, in areas on and beneath the Earth's surface, and in underwater regions. And in K, methods for the maintenance of peace and security during different stages of armed control and disarmament. You'll find out what they're talking about different stages when we get to 7277 and the blueprint for the peace phase. The scientific, economic, political, legal, social, psychological, military, and technological factors related to the prevention of war with a view to a better understanding of how the basic structure of a lasting peace may be established. M. Other related problems. Such related problems as the director may determine to be in need of research, development, or study in order to carry out the provisions of this chapter. The director is authorized and directed to prepare for the president, the secretary of state, and the heads of such other government agencies as the president may determine recommendations concerning United States arms control and disarmament policy. Provided, however, that no action shall be taken under this chapter or any other law that will obligate the United States to disarm or to reduce or to limit the armed forces or armaments of the United States, except pursuant to the treaty-making power of the President under the Constitution, or unless authorized by further affirmative legislation by the Congress of the United States. Nothing contained in this chapter shall be construed to authorize any policy or action by any government agency which would interfere with, restrict, or prohibit the acquisition, possession, or use of firearms by an individual for, and get this, folks, the lawful purpose of personal defense, sport, recreation, education, or training. Which means if there is a law that prohibits it, they can interfere all they want. Ladies and gentlemen, the law has already been accomplished. Treaties have already been written, signed, and approved by the Senate. We are in the process of disarming not only ourselves, but the rest of the world. Our armed forces will be assigned to the United Nations, and elements of what used to be the forces of the old Soviet Union will also be assigned to the United Nations as a one-world police force. It's already a done deal. I continue with Title 22, Foreign Relations and Intercourse, page 657, subsection 2576, paragraph C. And here's where all that was written before gets nullified. And it means that they can do whatever they want. Listen carefully. Prohibition of courts to compel statutory performance or review adequacy of statutory performance of government agencies or director. No court shall have any jurisdiction under any law to compel the performance of any requirement of this action or to review the adequacy of the performance of any such requirement on the part of any government agency, including the agency and the director. So you can't even go see what they're doing. Okay, let's go to Public Law 87-2. Let me start over again. Arms Control and Disarmament Act. For legislative history of acts, see page 2903. Public Law 87-297, 75 Statutes at Large, 631, H.R. 9118, an act to establish a United States Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. And this is from the United States Code, Congressional and Administrative News, Volume 1, 1961. We have many other sources also. United States Statutes at Large, 89th Congress, 1961, first session. excuse me. I'm still having fighting this throat, folks. I'm forcing my voice over here, and I just hope it lasts. Title 1, short title, purpose and definitions. Short title, Section 1. This act may be cited as the Arms Control and Disarmament Act. Purpose, Section 2, an ultimate goal of the United States is a world which is free from the scourge of war and the dangers and burdens of armaments, in which the use of force has been subordinated to the rule of law, and in which international adjustments to a changing world are achieved peacefully. It is the purpose of this act to provide impetus toward this goal by creating a new agency of peace to deal with the problem of reduction and control of armaments looking toward ultimate world disarmament. And it goes on to repeat the law verbatim, just as I have previously read it to you. It's just another source. This is Public Law 87-297, Laws of the 87th Congress, First Session. Definitions. Section 8, as used in this act. The terms arms control and disarmament means the identification, verification, inspection, limitation, control, reduction, elimination of armed forces and armaments of all kinds under international agreement, including the necessary steps taken under such an agreement to establish an effective system of international control or to create and strengthen international organizations for the maintenance of peace. Title II Organization, United States Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, Section 21. There is hereby established an agency to be known as the United States Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. The director shall be paid $22,500 per annum. A deputy director shall be paid $21,500 per annum. Assistant director and his salary is listed as $20,000 per annum. The director, under the direction of the Secretary of State, may establish within the agency such bureaus, offices, and divisions as he may determine to be necessary to discharge his responsibilities under this act, including but not limited to an office of the General Counsel. And it goes into the same articles on research, etc. September 26th, Public Law 87-297, Laws of the 87th Congress, First Session, page 710. A. The detection, identification, inspection, monitoring, limitation, reduction, control, and elimination of armed forces and armaments, including thermonuclear, nuclear missile, conventional, bacteriological, chemical, and radiological weapons. Your weapons fall under conventional. B. Techniques and systems of detecting, identifying, inspecting, and monitoring of tests of nuclear, thermonuclear, and other weapons. C. The analysis of national budgets, levels of industrial production, and economic indicators to determine the amount spent by various countries for armaments. D. Listen to this carefully. The control, reduction, and elimination of armed forces and armaments in space, in areas on and beneath the Earth's surface, and in underwater regions. And I'm going to skip down to G. The reduction and elimination of the danger of war resulting from accident, miscalculation, or possible surprise attack, including, but not limited to, improvements in the methods of communications between nations. I skip down to K, methods for the maintenance of peace and security during different stages of arms control and disarmament. You see, this isn't proposed. They already have stages decided upon, folks. We're in stage two. Under paragraph L, the scientific, economic, political, legal, social, psychological, military, and technological factors related to the prevention of war with a view to a better understanding of how the basic structure of a lasting peace may be established. M, such related problems as the director may determine to be in need of research, development, or study in order to carry out the provisions of this act. On page 711, under policy formation, the director is authorized and directed to prepare for the president, the secretary of state, and the heads of such other government agencies as the president may determine recommendations concerning United States arms control and disarmament policy, provided, however, that no action shall be taken under this or any other law that will obligate the United States to disarm or to reduce or to limit the armed forces or armaments of the United States. And this is the catch. You see, that makes you feel secure, doesn't it? Well, listen to this, sheeple. Except pursuant to the treaty-making power of the President under the Constitution or unless authorized by further affirmative legislation by the Congress of the United States. Now, when they wrote this, they know that the Constitution has been replaced, let me say that again in case you don't know it yet, has been replaced by the United Nations Charter under the United Nations Treaty and the UN Participation Act, pushed through by Harry S. Truman, 33rd degree Freemason, who was the Grand Master of the Grand Lodge of Missouri, of the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry, Southern Jurisdiction. So when they say under the Constitution, they really mean under the United Nations Charter. And when they say are unless authorized by further affirmative legislation, ladies and gentlemen, that legislation has been passed. And we will read it to you when it comes up to the top of the pile. We go now to page 712. And that's Title IV, General Provisions, General Authority, and the Performance of His Functions. The Director is authorized to, and we go down to paragraph C. Enter into agreements with other government agencies, including the military departments, through the Secretary of Defense, under which officers or employees of such agencies may be detailed to the agency for the performance of service pursuant to this act, without prejudice to the status or advancement of such officers or employees within their own agencies. D. Procure services of experts and consultants or organizations thereof, including stenographic reporting services, as authorized by Section 15 of the Act of August 2, 1946, 5 United States Code 55A, at rates not to exceed $100 per diem for individuals, and to pay in connection therewith travel expenses of individuals, including transportation and per diem in lieu of subsistence, while away from their homes or regular places of business, as authorized by Section 5 of said Act, as amended by 5 U.S. United States Code 73B. I skip over to contracts or expenditures, Section 43. The President may, in advance, exempt actions of the Director from the provisions of law relating to contracts or expenditures of government funds whenever he determines that such action is essential in the interest of United States arms control and disarmament and security policy. So right there, folks, you know they're doing something pretty sneaky because they're exempted from the law of contracts or accountability. Page 714, under security requirements. They're supposed to be working for disarmament. What's to hide there, folks? Security requirements, Section 45A. The Director shall establish such security and loyalty requirements, restrictions, and safeguards as he deems necessary in the interest of the national security and to carry out the provisions of this Act. The Director shall arrange with the Civil Service Commission for the conduct of full field background security and loyalty investigations of all the agency's officers, employees, consultants, persons detailed from other government agencies, members of its General Advisory Committee, advisory boards, contractors and subcontractors, and their officers and employees, actual or prospective. In the event the investigation discloses information indicating that the person investigated may or may become a security risk, or may be of doubtful loyalty, the report of the investigation shall be turned over to the Federal Bureau of Investigation for a full field investigation. The final results of all such investigations shall be turned over to the Director for final determination. And I go all the way over to page 715, in the same, under security requirements. It says, the Atomic Energy Commission finds that the established personnel and other security procedures and standards of the agencies are adequate and in reasonable conformity to the standards established by the Atomic Energy Commission under Section 2165 of Title 42, including those for interim clearance in the subsection B thereof. Any individual granted access to such restricted data pursuant to this subsection may exchange such data with any individual who, A, is an officer or employee of the Department of Defense, or any department or agency thereof, or a member of the armed forces, or an officer or employee of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, or a contractor or subcontractor of any such department, agency, or armed force, or an officer or employee of any such contractor or subcontractor, and B has been authorized to have access to restricted data under the provisions of Section 2163 or 2455 of Title 42. Now, what do they mean by all this, folks? What do they mean by loyalty? Loyalty to who? Loyalty to what? Well, you never know, folks, because later here, you're going to find out that the Director of the Disarmament Agency has been given, under the law, the authority to decide. And instead of stating the oath of all of these people are to take in the law, it merely says that the Director of the Disarmament Agency shall determine what oath they shall take. What oath they shall take. And we've already tried to get a copy of the oath that they take, and we're denied. Page 716, appropriation. Section 49. A. There are hereby authorized to be appropriated not to exceed $10 million to remain available until expended to carry out the purposes of this act. Report to Congress, Section 50. The director shall submit to the president for transmittal to the Congress, not later than January 31st of each year, a report concerning activities of the agency. Approved September 26, 1961. Now we go to the Congressional Record of the House, 1961, page 20301. The clerk read as follows. Amendment offered by Mr. Morgan on part 2, or page 2, line 2, after the word peacefully, insert a period. The amendment was agreed to, and the clerk read as follows. Definitions, section 3, as used in this act. A. The term disarmament includes the control, elimination, reduction, limitation, inspection, verification, or identification of armed forces and armaments of all kinds under international agreement, including the necessary steps taken under such an agreement to establish an effective system of international control or to create and strengthen international organizations for the maintenance of peace. Mr. Quay, Mr. Chairman, I offer an amendment. The clerk read as follows. Amendment offered by Mr. Quay on page 3, line 12, strike out the word elimination. The chairman. The gentleman from Minnesota is recognized. Mr. Quay. Mr. Chairman, if we strike out the word elimination in line 12, the definition will read A. The term disarmament includes the control, reduction, limitation, inspection, verification, or identification of armed forces and armaments of all kinds. I think it would be unwise, dangerous, and foolish to state in a bill that disarmament means the elimination of armed forces and armaments of all kinds. There would be nothing more dangerous for this country. There would be nothing more dangerous in the cause of world peace than to have any important country lay down its arms completely. There is no nation in the world today that is not dominated by another nation that has eliminated its armed or its armed forces completely. You can see the way the people who have called themselves the non-committed nations in Belgrade look to a country like Russia that has great arms and who has talked and acted tough. I think that is why they talked mostly about colonialism but did not object strenuously to the testing of the atomic bomb by Russia or any of colonialistic and aggressive acts. You can imagine what would happen in case we, under an international agreement, eliminated all armed forces, even every soldier and all weapons whatsoever. All another nation would have to do would be to secretly have a few armed forces and a few devastating weapons, and immediately we would be unable to defend ourselves. Now that there are these new kinds of weapons, especially nuclear weapons. Quite a bit has been written on this subject. There could be arms control at a reasonable level with inspection and an identification of these weapons. Then, if in a sneaky way some country should add a few more troops, should add a few more weapons, it would be difficult for us to protect ourselves. It is just like some people want in this country for nobody to have any weapons at all. Should that happen in this country, we would find the police force unable to cope with the criminals and the honest citizens unable to cope with the police force. We have to have an armed force, and under any international agency, I imagine not only would they have their own police force, but they would have access to the armed forces of those countries in the international agreement who are friendly to the cause in case of an aggression against a peaceful country. So I believe if we are to have a meaningful arms control, we should take out this word elimination and remove it from this bill. The argument continues, ladies and gentlemen, and the outcome is that it is not removed. It is not removed.
one solitary, lonely, helpless man, one man with no arms, who walked upon this earth 2,000 years ago, changed the entire world for the 2,000 years that followed his death. He said, and I quote, "My people perish for lack of knowledge," unquote. During this hour, ladies and gentlemen, I will read to you verbatim from the text of the Blueprint for the Peace Race, outline of basic provisions of a treaty on general and complete disarmament in a peaceful world. This was printed by the United States Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. It is publication number 4. United States Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, publication number 4, General Series 3, released May 1962. That's the United States Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, publication number 4, General Series 3, released May 1962. It was for sale by the Superintendent of Documents, United States Government Printing Office, Washington 25, D.C. I quote, "Not to an arms race, but to a peace race, to advance together step by step, stage by stage, until general and complete disarmament has been achieved," unquote. Signed by President John Fitzgerald Kennedy, September 25, 1961. This is a verbatim statement by the President, John F. Kennedy, during a press conference, April 18, 1962. Pay attention. The United States has today tabled at Geneva an outline of every basic provision of a treaty on general and complete disarmament in a peaceful world. It provides a blueprint of our position on general and complete disarmament, as well as elaboration of the nature, sequence, and timing of specific disarmament measures. This outline of a treaty represents the most comprehensive and specific series of proposals the United States or any other country has ever made on disarmament. In addition to stating the objectives and principles which should govern agreements for disarmament, the document calls for the grouping of individual measures in three balanced and safeguarded stages. We are hopeful through the give and take of the conference table this plan will have a constructive influence upon the negotiations now in process. I want to stress that with this plan, the United States is making a major effort to achieve a breakthrough on disarmament negotiations. We believe that the nations represented at Geneva have a heavy responsibility to lay the foundations for a genuinely secure and peaceful world, starting through a reduction in arms, unquote. Now, ladies and gentlemen, that sounds very nice. It sounds wonderful. It's the ages-old dream of 1,000 years of utopia on Earth, brought to fruition through the great work of the many different brotherhoods, the secret societies operating under different names and at times appearing to oppose themselves. Ladies and gentlemen, their plan is coming to fruition very quickly. How would you disarm the world without having a central power and a central police force to enforce the disarmament of the world? And this plan includes the peoples of the world, including the American peoples. All of this lily, wonderful, utopian-sounding rhetoric that comes from the mouths of these people who have been working to destroy the United States of America lay against your ears like a soft feather on a puff of wind. But the truth is, ladies and gentlemen, that feather always ultimately erupts in a burst of flame that consumes not only the ear, but the head and the body. It is the ages-old lie, the promise of something good, and you always have to give up everything to get it. And whoever's calling, you might as well stop, because no one is going to answer this telephone. And I continue. Forward. An ultimate goal of the United States is a world which is free from the scourge of war and the dangers and burdens of armaments.
in which the use of force has been subordinated to the rule of law, and in which international adjustments to a changing world are achieved peacefully. Today, in a world riven by dangerous tensions and mistrust, the attainment of this goal necessitates continuing and patient efforts to achieve the progressive reduction of national war-making capabilities in such a manner as to increase the security of all nations. Thus, responsible arms control and disarmament proposals cannot be directed toward the attainment of unilateral political or military advantage. They must be fully responsive to the legitimate security interests of all nations. On the basis of these considerations, President Kennedy on September 25, 1961, presented to the General Assembly of the United Nations the United States Program for General and Complete Disarmament in a Peaceful World. To provide a more precise statement of the United States' approach to disarmament and the manner in which that approach should be implemented, the United States on April 18, 1962, presented to the conference of the 18-Nation Committee on Disarmament meeting in Geneva an outline of basic provisions of a treaty on general and complete disarmament in a peaceful world. Although not a draft treaty, the outline elaborates and extends the proposals of September 25th and provides a specific term, a substantial basis for the negotiation of arms control and disarmament treaty obligations. The principal provisions of the United States outline are described in the summary that follows. The complete text of the outline begins on page 5. Ladies and gentlemen, that also sounds nice. Wouldn't it be nice to have a peaceful world free from war? If you've studied history, as I have, you will find out that the wars that have been fought in the last 150 years have been fought to bring this plan of world government into reality. Outline of basic provisions of a treaty on general and complete disarmament in a peaceful world. Summary. Principle and process of disarmament. Disarmament would be implemented progressively and in a balanced manner so that at no stage could any state or group of states obtain military advantage. Compliance with obligations would be effectively verified. As national armaments were reduced, the United Nations would be progressively strengthened. Did you hear that, sheeple? And you've been telling me there is no plan for world government? You better wake up. You have been stupid long enough. You have been apathetic long enough. You have been irresponsible and ignorant long enough. There is no time left, as you will soon see. Disarmament would be accomplished in three stages. The first to be carried out in 3 years. The second also in 3 years. And the third as promptly as possible within an agreed period of time. Stage one would be initiated by the United States, the Soviet Union, and other agreed states, and that has been done. All militarily significant states would participate in stage two, and that is in the process of being done. And all states possessing armaments and armed forces in stage three. I'll repeat that. And all states possessing armaments and armed forces in stage three. Transition from one stage of disarmament to the next would take place upon a determination that all undertakings in the preceding stage had been carried out and that all preparations for the next stage had been made. Disarmament measures. Armaments. During stage one, inventories of major categories of both nuclear delivery vehicles and conventional armaments would be reduced by 30%. That has been surpassed. Fixed launching pads would be reduced with associated missiles. That has also been done. Half of the remaining inventories would be eliminated during stage two. That is being accomplished at the present time. And final reductions would be made in stage three. Upon the completion of stage three, states would have at their disposal only agreed types of non-nuclear armaments for forces required to maintain internal order and protect the personal security of citizens. Production of armaments during stage one would be limited to agreed allowances and would be compensated for by the destruction of additional armaments to the end that reductions would not be impaired, and that has been done. In stage two, production of armaments would be halted except for parts for maintenance of retained armaments. Any further production of national armaments would be ended in stage three, except for production of agreed types of non-nuclear armaments for internal forces. Military research, development, and testing would be subject to increasing limitations during this disarmament progress. During stage three, appropriate action would be taken to ensure that new scientific discoveries and technological inventories and inventions of military significance were not used for military purposes. B. Armed forces. Force levels of the United States and Soviet Union would be reduced to 2.1 million at the end of stage one, and that has been more than accomplished. Half of the remaining forces of these two states would be disbanded during stage two, and that is being accomplished at the present time, and in the United States is well ahead of schedule. And final reductions would be made in stage three. Other states would also progressively reduce their force levels. By the end of stage three, states would have at their disposal only those agreed forces and related organizational arrangements required to maintain internal order and protect the personal security of citizens. Notice that the military force of nations is now turned inward and is not to protect from attack from without, but is to maintain internal order. C. Nuclear weapons. Production of fissionable materials for use in nuclear weapons would be halted in stage one, and limitations would be imposed on the production of fissionable materials for other purposes. The availability of fissionable materials for use in nuclear weapons would be reduced during stage one and subsequent stages by safeguarded transfers to non-nuclear weapons purposes. That is being accomplished. If nuclear weapons tests had not already been halted under effective international control, arrangements to this end would be undertaken in stage one. States which had manufactured nuclear weapons would agree in stage one not to transfer control over nuclear weapons to states which had not manufactured them or to assist such states in their manufacture. States which had not manufactured nuclear weapons would refrain from seeking them. That is being enforced at the present time. Transfers of fissionable materials between states would be limited to peaceful purposes and would be safeguarded, and that is being accomplished at this time. Beginning in stage two, non-nuclear components and assemblies of nuclear weapons would be destroyed, and limitations would be imposed on further production or refabrication of nuclear weapons. At the end of stage two, remaining nuclear weapons would be registered internationally to assist in verifying the fact that by the end of stage three, states would not have such weapons at their disposal. That is, at the present time, being accomplished both in the United States and in the Soviet Union. D. Outer space. The placing of weapons of mass destruction in orbit would be prohibited in stage one, and limitations would be imposed on the production, stockpiling, and testing of boosters for space vehicles. States would support increased cooperation in peaceful uses of outer space. E. Military bases. Reduction of military bases, wherever they might be located, would be initiated in stage two, and final reductions would be made in stage three. And in the United States, this plan has been implemented and is ahead of schedule. F. Military expenditures. Military expenditures would be reported throughout the disarmament process, and that is not only being carried out, but it is public information. Verification. The verification of disarmament would be the responsibility of an international disarmament organization which would be established within the framework of the United Nations, and that has been done, and that organization is monitoring the disarmament of the major superpowers. Reductions of armaments and armed forces would be verified at agreed locations, and limitations on production, testing, and other specified activities at declared locations. Assurance that agreed levels of armaments and armed forces were not exceeded and that activities subject to limitation or prohibition were not being conducted clandestinely would be provided through arrangements which would relate the extent of inspection at any time to the amount of disarmament being undertaken and to the risk to the disarming states of possible violations. Such assurance might, for example, be accomplished through arrangements under which states would divide themselves into a number of zones or regions through which inspection would be progressively extended. By the end of stage three, when disarmament had been completed, all parts of the territory of states would have been inspected. Reduction of the risk of war. To promote confidence and reduce the risk of war during the disarmament process, states would, beginning in stage one, give advance notification of major military movements and maneuvers, establish observation posts to report on concentrations and movements of military forces, and ensure rapid and reliable communications among heads of government and with the Secretary General of the United Nations. An International Commission on Reduction of the Risk of War would examine possible extensions and improvements of such measures, as well as additional measures to reduce the risk of war through accident, miscalculation, failure of communications, or surprise attack. Arrangements for keeping the peace. In stage one, states would undertake obligations to refrain from the threat or use of force of any type contrary to the United Nations Charter. Throughout the three stages of disarmament, states would use all available means for the peaceful settlements of disputes, would seek to improve processes for this purpose, and would support measures to improve the capability of the United Nations to maintain international peace and security. A United Nations Peace Observation Corps would be established in Stage 1 and a United Nations Peace Force in Stage 2. That has been accomplished. The military forces of the United States that are left are functioning as the United Nations Peace Force. We are, in fact, in Stage 2 at this moment. The United Nations Peace Force, which would be equipped with agreed types of armaments and would be supplied agreed manpower by states, would be progressively strengthened until in Stage 3 it would be fully capable of ensuring international security in a disarmed world. It would then be turned over completely to the United Nations and would be merged with the military forces of what used to be called the Soviet Union. The outline of basic provisions of a treaty on general and complete disarmament in a peaceful world. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the complete text. I will read selected portions of this complete text, simply because it's long. But you will get the message, and you will be able to obtain this entire text. In order to assist in the preparation of a treaty on general and complete disarmament in a peaceful world, the United States submits the following outline of basic provisions of such a treaty. A. Objectives. 1. To ensure that A. disarmament is general and complete, war is no longer an instrument for settling international problems, and B. general and complete disarmament is accompanied by the establishment of reliable procedures for the settlement of disputes and by effective arrangements for the maintenance of peace in accordance with the principles of the Charter of the United Nations. You people better wake up. I'm putting my life on the line for you. You better wake up. 2. Taking into account paragraphs 3 and 4 below to provide with respect to the military establishment of every nation for A. disbanding of armed forces, dismantling of military establishments, including bases, cessation of the production of armaments, as well as their liquidation or conversion to peaceful uses, elimination of all stockpiles of nuclear, chemical, biological, and other weapons of mass destruction, and cessation of the production of such weapons. C. Elimination of all means of delivery of weapons of mass destruction. D. Abolition of the organizations and institutions designed to organize the military efforts of states, cessation of military training, and closing of all military training institutions. E. Discontinuance of military expenditures. Paragraph 3. To ensure that at the completion of the program for general and complete disarmament, states would have at their disposal only those non-nuclear armaments, forces, facilities, and establishments as are agreed to be necessary to maintain internal order and protect the personal security of citizens. To ensure that during and after implementation of general and complete disarmament, states also would support and provide agreed manpower for a United Nations peace force to be equipped with agreed types of armaments necessary to ensure that the United Nations can effectively deter or suppress any threat or use of arms, which means there will no longer be a United States of America, for we will have no sovereignty, and the United Nations Charter will be the supreme law of the land, and I tell you now, it already is and has been for some time. There is no Bill of Rights in the United Nations Charter. There is a clause that outlaws religion unless they are legal. The United Nations has only approved one religion in its history. You've got to help, folks. You must help. We don't have any time left. There's no time left, period. Paragraph 5, to establish and provide for the effective operation of an international disarmament organization within the framework of the United Nations for the purpose of ensuring that all obligations under the disarmament program would be honored and observed during and after implementation of general and complete disarmament. And to this end, to ensure that the International Disarmament Organization and its inspectors would have unrestricted access without veto to all places as necessary for the purpose of effective verification. B. Principles. The guiding principles during the achievement of these objectives are, 1. Disarmament would be implemented until it is completed by stages to be carried out within specified time limits. 2. Disarmament would be balanced, so that at no stage of the implementation of the treaty could any state or group of states gain military advantage, and so that security would be ensured equally for all. 3. Compliance with all disarmament obligations would be effectively verified during and after their entry into force. Verification arrangements would be instituted progressively as necessary to ensure throughout the disarmament process that agreed levels of armaments and armed forces were not exceeded. 4. As national armaments are reduced, the United Nations would be progressively strengthened in order to improve its capacity to ensure international security and the peaceful settlement of differences, as well as to facilitate the development of international cooperation in common tasks for the benefit of mankind. There's that old benefit of mankind again, that the Brotherhood is so fond of scattering around. 5. Transition from one stage of disarmament to the next would take place upon decision that all measures in the preceding stage had been implemented and verified, and that any additional arrangements required for measures in the next stage were ready to operate. We have been betrayed. We have been lied to. The Brady Bill, all these bills on gun control, that's just dressing on the cake, folks. The cake's already been made, baked, and eaten. It's all over. And it was all over a long time ago. There is no United States of America. There is a United Nations. Our military commanders know this. Congress knows it. The President knows it. The Justice Department knows it. And the Supreme Court knows it. As you will find out in the coming programs as I read you verbatim from the law. Don't go away. I might be back. I just might be back. And if I am, I guarantee you, you don't want to miss it. Because even if you don't care, it's the best thing on radio. introduction. And remember, I'm only going to read selected portions. You will be able to get your hands on this as we publish it. And even if we don't publish it, if you're diligent in your research, you will find your own copy without having to go through with us. And then you'll know that we did not make this up. And that's the way that I prefer that you do it. Introduction. The treaty would contain three stages designed to achieve a permanent state of general and complete disarmament in a peaceful world. The treaty would enter into force upon the signature and ratification of the United States of America. Did you hear that, folks? The treaty would enter into force upon the signature and ratification of the United States of America. That was done a long time ago. The Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, and that was done a long time ago, and such other states as might be agreed. Stage two would begin when all militarily significant states had become parties to the treaty and other transition requirements had been satisfied. Stage three would begin when all states possessing armed forces and armaments had become parties to the treaty and other transition requirements had been satisfied. In fact, that has not been implemented and is not a part of the treaty. Disarmament, verification, and measures for keeping the peace would proceed progressively and proportionately, beginning with the entry into force of the treaty. Stage one would begin upon the entry into force of the treaty and would be completed within 3 years from that date. During stage one, the parties to the treaty would undertake, one, to reduce their armaments and armed forces and to carry out other agreed measures in the manner outlined below. Two, to establish the International Disarmament Organization upon the entry into force of the treaty in order to ensure the verification in the agreed manner of the obligations undertaken. And three, to strengthen arrangements for keeping the peace through the measures outlined below. Stage one took much longer than 3 years. You can mark the beginning of the signing of the treaty by the date that the International Disarmament Organization under the United Nations was created. We are now in stage two, ladies and gentlemen. Armaments, reduction of armaments. Specified parties to the treaty as a first stage toward general and complete disarmament in a peaceful world would reduce by 30% the armaments in each category listed in subparagraph B below, except as adjustments for production would be permitted in stage one in accordance with paragraph three below. Each type of armament in the categories listed in subparagraph B would be reduced by 30% of the inventory existing at an agreed date. That has been accomplished. I'm going to skip a little bit now. Methods of reduction. Those parties to the treaty which were subject to the reduction of armaments would submit to the International Disarmament Organization an appropriate declaration respecting inventories of their armaments existing at the agreed date. We have had members of the International Disarmament Organization visiting our arsenals and manufacturing facilities in the United States for several years now. B, the reduction would be accomplished in three steps, each consisting of 1 year. One-third of the reduction to be made during stage one would be carried out during each step. During the first part of each step, one-third of the armaments to be eliminated during stage one would be placed in depots under supervision of the International Disarmament Organization. During the second part of each step, the deposited armaments would be destroyed or, where appropriate, converted to peaceful uses. That has been done. In accordance with arrangements which would be set forth in a treaty annex on verification, the International Disarmament Organization would verify the foregoing reduction and would provide assurance that retained armaments did not exceed agreed levels. That's been done. Let me skip over to something. Armed forces. Reduction of armed forces. Force levels for the United States of America and the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics would be reduced to 2.1 million each, and for other specified parties to the treaty to agreed levels not exceeding 2.1 million each. All other parties to the treaty would, with agreed exceptions, reduce their force levels to 100,000 or 1% of their population, whichever were higher, provided that in no case would the force levels of such other parties to the treaty exceed levels in existence upon the entries into force of the treaty, and that has been accomplished. Armed forces subject to reduction. Agreed force levels would include all full-time uniformed personnel maintained by national governments in the following categories. A, career personnel of active armed forces and other personnel serving in the active armed forces on fixed engagements or contracts. B, conscripts performing their required period of full-time active duty as fixed by national law. C, personnel of militarily organized security forces and of other forces or organizations equipped and organized to perform a military mission. And, of course, I'm going to skip over the part of nuclear weapons and outer space. Military expenditures. The parties to the treaty would submit to the International Disarmament Organization at the end of each step of each stage a report on their military expenditures. Such reports would include an itemization of military expenditures. So if they're doing that, folks, what is all this bullshit about national security? Secrecy on the military expenditures when they're turned over to the United Nations. This is absolutely amazing. Specified parties to the treaty would undertake the exchange of military missions between states or groups of states in order to improve communications and understanding between them. Specific arrangements respecting such exchanges would be agreed. That has been going on for several years. We have military officers attending the Russian military academies. They have military officers attending our military academies. We have now Russian troops on United States soil with their various equipment. We have an open skies treaty, and they are allowed to overfly our airspace any time they want, and we are equally allowed to overfly theirs. Specified parties to the treaty would agree to the establishment of rapid and reliable communications among their heads of government and with the Secretary General of the United Nations, who is the true president of the world, ladies and gentlemen. Specific arrangements in this regard would be subject to agreement among the parties concerned between such parties and the Secretary General. Many of you have called and asked me, who does Boutros Ghali think he is? He talks to us and the other people in the world like he's running the world. Well, you stupid sheeple, he is. He is running the world. And it's about time you know it. It's about time you got mad about it. And it's way past time we all started doing something about it. Go read the United Nations Charter. Read the resolutions that have been passed by the United Nations. Then you might begin to get a little hint of where we're headed. Right down the tubes. Right down the tubes, folks. I don't know how long my voice is going to last, but I'm going to try to get through all of this, and I'm going to continue until I drop, and Carolyn is getting sick now, so I don't know what's going to happen here, but we're going to continue as long as we can. The parties to the treaty would agree to cooperate promptly and fully with the International Disarmament Organization and to assist the International Disarmament Organization in the performance of its functions and in the execution of the decisions made by it in accordance with the provisions of the treaty. Measures providing for reduction of armaments would be verified by the International Disarmament Organization as agreed depots and would include verification of the destruction of armaments and, where appropriate, verification of the conversion of armaments to peaceful uses. Measures providing the reduction of armed forces would be verified by the International Disarmament Organization either at the agreed depots or other agreed locations. Measures halting or limiting production, testing, and other specified activities would be verified by the International Disarmament Organization. Parties to the treaty would declare the nature and location of all production and testing facilities and other specified activities. The International Disarmament Organizations would have access to relevant facilities and activities wherever located in the territory of such parties. Down the page, all parts of the territory of those parties to the treaty to which this form of verification was applicable would be subject to selection for inspection from the beginning of stage one as provided. Parties that do the treaty would divide their territory into an agreed number of appropriate zones, and at the beginning of each step of disarmament would submit to the International Disarmament Organization a declaration stating the total level of armaments, forces, and specified types of activities subject to verification within each zone. The exact location of armaments and forces within a zone would not be revealed prior to its selection for inspection. That's why, ladies and gentlemen, the United States has been divided into regions. Both aerial and mobile ground inspection would be employed within the zone being inspected. Access within the zone would be free and unimpeded, and verification would be carried out with the full cooperation of the state being inspected. Once the zone had been inspected, it would remain open for further inspection while verification was being extended to additional zones. By the end of Stage 3, when all disarmament measures had been completed, inspection would have been extended to all parts of the territory of parties to the treaty. I told you, folks, it's a done deal. Requesting the International Court of Justice to give advisory opinions on legal questions concerning the interpretation or application of the treaty, subject to a general authorization of this power by, guess who? The General Assembly of the United Nations. Requesting the International Court of Justice to give advisory opinions on legal questions concerning the interpretation or application of the treaty, subject to a general authorization of this power by the General Assembly of the United Nations. And it continues, and it continues, and it continues, and it includes all nations, all military forces, and all peoples, including you. It was done years ago, ladies and gentlemen. Years ago. And let me see if there's anything else here that you need to hear right off the bat. Yes, here we go. United Nations Peace Force. The parties to the treaty would undertake to develop arrangements during Stage 1 for the establishment in Stage 2 of a United Nations Peace Force. To this end, the parties to the treaty would agree on the following measures within the United Nations. Examination of the experience of the United Nations leading to a further strengthening of United Nations forces for keeping the peace. B. Examination of the feasibility of conducting or concluding promptly the agreements envisioned in Article 43 of the United Nations Charter. I want you all to look at the United Nations Charter and read Article 43. Then, when you have sufficiently recovered, stay tuned for the next hour of the time. Conclusion of an agreement for the establishment of a United Nations Peace Force in Stage 2. Including definitions of its purpose, mission, composition and strength, disposition, command and control, training, logistical support, financing, equipment, and armaments. United Nations Peace Observation Corps. The parties to the treaty would agree to support the establishment within the United Nations of a Peace Observation Corps staffed with a standing cadre of observers who could be dispatched promptly to investigate any situation which might constitute a threat to or breach of the peace. Elements of the Peace Observation Corps could also be stationed as appropriate in selected areas throughout the world. If upon the expiration of such period of periods, that's after group one, or stage one, two, and three is passed, one or more of the permanent members of the Control Council should declare that the foregoing circumstances did not exist, the question would be placed before a special session of the Security Council. Transition to Stage 2 would take place upon a determination by the Security Council that the foregoing circumstances did in fact exist. Thank you, Carolyn. Hot or not, I need it. During Stage 2, the parties to the treaty would undertake to continue all obligations undertaken during Stage 1. To reduce further the armament and armed forces reduced during Stage 1 and to carry out additional measures of disarmament in the manner outlined below. To ensure that the International Disarmament Organization would have the capacity to verify in the agreed manner the obligations undertaken during Stage 2, and to strengthen further the arrangements for keeping the peace through the establishment
of a United Nations peace force and through the additional measures outlined below.
And, here we go. Now we're getting to the meat of the matter. Armaments. Reduction of armaments. I'm going to skip through all of this military stuff, and I'm going to go right down. The parties to the treaty would submit to the International Disarmaments Organization a declaration respecting their inventories existing at the beginning of Stage 2 of the additional types of armaments in the categories listed in subparagraph B below, and would, during Stage 2, reduce the inventory of each type of such armaments by 50%. B. All types of armaments within further agreed categories would be subject to reduction in Stage 2. And we go down to item number 8, specified types of small arms, which will be declarations by types. That is being carried out in law now. Under 8 and C, specified categories of ammunition for armaments listed in Stage 1. Section A, subparagraph 1B, and in subparagraph B above would be reduced to levels consistent with the levels of armaments agreed for the end of Stage 2. Then it goes through the method of reduction, eliminating the production of ammunition, eliminating the production of firearms of all types, reduction of armed forces. We're going to be stripped of any means of our protecting ourselves against this despotic world government, which will be run and controlled by international socialism. And you will learn that when I get into Mikhail Gorbachev's book called Perestroika, which he recently wrote, and none of you went and bought, and you should have all bought it and read it from cover to cover. Military bases and facilities. The parties to the treaty would dismantle or convert to peaceful uses agreed military bases and facilities wherever they might be located. We have not only dismantled or converted to peaceful uses many, many of our military bases throughout this country, but we gave one to Mikhail Gorbachev, the Presidio in San Francisco, and he is sitting there now laughing at us. It is the headquarters of the Gorbachev Foundation. You know what the goal of the Gorbachev Foundation is? Oh, the dear sheeple. If you only knew, if I could just shake you and wake you up. If I could just do something to make you understand what it is that we're losing. If we were given a hand in this, if we were allowed to participate and debate and help form what is coming, we might be able to create something good. Just the fact that it is being brought about through lies and deception and manipulation, and the death of many, many good people around the world, tells me that there's nothing good about it. In fact, it smells so bad, I can smell the stench right here in our studios under the clear, beautiful blue Arizona skies.
Well, we'll open the phones now, folks. What do you think about what you're hearing? 520-333-4578. Have you got a clue as to when we originally aired this series? I don't think it's over. We have weeks more to go. Weeks and weeks and weeks more to go. You see, if you had been listening to the Hour of the Time years ago, you would have been able to predict the current happenings today with the same kind of accuracy that I have been able to predict it. And you would have been absolutely 100% correct. 520-333-4578 is the number. Is this impacting you? Is it making a difference? Is it clearing anything up for you? Well, the phone rang, and then nobody was there. 520-333-4578. Or... is this too tedious? Have you succeeded in blocking it out? Are you practicing what's known as denial? Have you walked away from it? What is your statement about what you've been hearing for the last several nights? 520-333-4578 is the number. Are you just absolutely dumbfounded by it all? Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening, Bill. This is Denise in Southern Nevada.
Hi, Denise.
What I get from what you're doing tonight is that possibly Milosevic and Saddam Hussein have refused to disarm on their own.
Well, that's part of it. They've certainly refused to kowtow to the New World Order.
Well, that's what because I keep hearing this repeating of decreasing the amount of armament.
Yeah.
And I hear that from NATO, too. We're going to hurt his ability to wage war.
Sure. NATO is, as I predicted years ago, is being positioned as the official police force for the world.
Right. Okay. I just wanted to see if I was on track there.
Oh, yes. Absolutely you are.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. 520-333-4578 is the number. What do you think about what you're hearing? Is it opening your eyes? And remember, this is just the very small tip of the iceberg. We have just begun to reveal the treason that's been happening in this country. You have no idea whatsoever. That is, no idea yet. You will, as each night goes by, you will learn more and more and more. You see, we've been lied to big time. More than big time. Good evening. You're on the air.
Mr. Cooper.
Yes, sir.
This is the man back in Detroit, Michigan.
I know.
Who I am, Spiegel.
Yes, I do.
You know what I've been telling these guys long ago, that what you were saying is dead on track. This nation's going to end in total chaos because these fools are still sitting down twirling their fingers. Every time I try to tell some of the blacks about this, oh, you don't know what you're talking about. Congress ain't going to buy it for that black man to us. And you know, in the VFW, they're going around sending out letters to members of the VFW to back the guys in
Kosovo?
Yugoslavia.
Yeah.
And I told them, I'm a spiritual man. And what they're doing is wrong, and I don't violate the moral law. If any man violates the moral law, I don't want nothing to do with him. I don't care who it is, if it's my brother or my papa.
Uh-huh.
So, I just want to let you know.
I appreciate
my share. So keep up the good work.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay. Take care.
Thanks for calling. 520-333-4578. Is this worth doing? Should we continue it? Is it too tedious for you? Is it boring? I need to know these things. Good evening. You're on the air.
Well, good evening, Bill. I hope I'm coming through good.
Yes, you are.
I enjoy what I'm hearing very much. It is certainly worthwhile to continue.
Could you talk a lot louder, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. I have to yell. I'll make it quick. I want to say that what you're doing is certainly worthwhile. I'm enjoying every second.
Okay, I don't understand what you mean by enjoying. It's not an enjoyable thing to hear, really.
But I'm being educated, I'm thrilled with the joy of discovery.
Okay, I understand.
And, you know, you're opening my eyes.
Well, thank you.
Have a great evening.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
520-333-4578 is the number to call. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hey, Bill. This is Steve in Greenville, North Carolina. How you doing tonight?
I'm doing fine.
I just wanted to let you know that your broadcasts are they're absolutely incredible, sir. They're fabulous. They're eye-opening. I try to get as many people to listen to it and to tape it. I think you're just an asset. You're a hero of mine for what that is worth. I'm a young man growing up in modern Babylon, and I know that everything you say is true because it takes touches my heart and it touches my soul. And each night that I listen to these tapes that you've begun, you send chills up my spine and tears come out of my eyes because I know the truth of what you speak. And I just want everyone out there to know that you're just great, man. You just do a really good job, Bill. I appreciate you very much.
Thank you so much. You don't know how far that goes in helping me do this job. 520-333-4578 is the number. And, when you know all of this stuff, and you've been working with it for years and years and years, you talk about tears. I have shed rivers and rivers and rivers of tears knowing what's coming to the good people of this country and of the world. That is the death of freedom that we are witnessing. You see, when the President of the United States can collude or conspire with an international organization called NATO to throw all existing law in the trash can and coerce by overwhelming force other people to do as they dictate, I can't imagine anything more threatening or dangerous than that. Good evening. You're on the air.
Yes, Bill. This is Chris from Kalamazoo.
Hi, Chris.
And I just wanted to continue to encourage you in what you're doing. I have contacted the Kalamazoo Gazette, one of the three assistants to the editor, and he said he would try to get somebody to listen. He's a man of faith, a man that I trust and respect, and he's going to do what he can to get someone to listen to the shortwave broadcast and perhaps do some type of information on the in the paper on your programs.
Well, good. That's wonderful.
And the information that you're talking about tonight was in, I believe, one of the previous editions of Veritas. You had mentioned it, I believe.
Yes. Well, I've done this stuff in my speeches and lectures over the years. Part of it is in my book, Behold a Pale Horse.
Yes, sir.
These tapes that you're listening to were originally aired in 1994.
Okay.
1994! And not enough people paid attention to stop the crap that's going on now. Isn't that
incredible? I was awakened to your broadcast in about late 95, early 96. And I just want to thank you for continuing my wake-up program.
Well, thank you. We're out of time. I got to let you go.
All right, sir.
Good night, folks, and God bless each and every single one of you. Please, wake up. Form or join a militia. If you want to stay free, I hate to tell you this, but you're going to have to fight for it. Ladies and gentlemen, you know why William Jefferson Clinton named me William Cooper, the most dangerous radio host in America. It's because I tell you the truth. I don't care who it hurts or helps. I tell you the truth. You won't get it anywhere else.